What a great privilege to listen to and to sing hymns like we've sung tonight. And this has been lousy compared to what it's going to be like in heaven. Even guys like me will be able to sing there, and we'll all be able to blend our voices and sing, I think, unendingly to the Lamb on the throne. Well, it's been great to be here this evening. I made a little mistake this morning. I went to the luncheon, which wasn't a mistake, but I called it the Homewrecker Sunday School Group, and then I realized that that wasn't the name of the group. It was the Home Builders Sunday. So thank you very much for the nice lunch, and people have been very, very, very kind to us. Would you take your Bible, please, and turn to 1 Kings chapter 3, the passage the pastor read in our hearing a few minutes ago. We find ourselves tonight in the city of Jerusalem. Not in the streets, not in the suburbs, the areas where people reside, but in the place of justice. Solomon will do some amazing building before his kingdom is through. He will take 7 years building the temple. He will take another 13 years to build his palaces, his court of justice, and the various building complexes that will make up his administration. But tonight, he is presiding in a court case. You may not notice initially, but there are two trials going on at the same time in the passage we've read this evening. And that's very important for us to understand. Certainly the writer of Kings understood that. The first trial at least seems pretty obvious, and we'll look at that trial in a minute. But the greater trial is maybe not quite so obvious. We, because we're people, because we relate through our senses, because we interact with the things that we can take in with all those data-gathering devices the Lord has given us, such as ears and eyes and so on, we might, if we're not careful tonight, think that Solomon is being tested. But he isn't. The one who's on trial tonight, besides the ladies of the night, is God. The question is, the case before us is, does God hear and answer prayer? Does God keep his promises? Does God really do what he says he will do? Nothing has changed about the world that Solomon is a part of. And frankly, nothing ever will until the Lord of Glory himself returns to do a massive renovation of this whole thing, so that when he is through, this earth will be where righteousness dwells. It's not like that now. In the new heavens and the new earth, there will be no courts. There will be no judges. There will be no lawyers. I thought there'd be a few amens. There'd be no plaintiffs, no defendants, because there'll be no sin, because there will be no injustice, because there will be nothing that is unrighteous. The judge of all the earth will judge all the earth. But the difficulty for the believer is that while we live down here before that day, the great question in our minds is, does God really answer prayer? Does he keep his word? Does he fulfill what he has promised to do? You have a political system that seems to love to track what politicians have promised, and then, of course, to track how much they're keeping their word. And in theory, their electability again will be depending primarily on how they kept their promises from the first time around. And with a lot of people, their difficulty with God is they're not convinced that he keeps his word, that he answers prayer, that he does what he says he will do. A man, a mortal, a sinful man, spoke with the true and the living God, and he says, I am incompetent to be the person you've asked me to be, because what you've asked me to do is not run America or run Canada or rule over Russia. You have asked me to care for your chosen people. And humanly, that is impossible. I will need gifts. I will need wisdom in particular. I will need the kind of heart that only God can give and only God can maintain if I'm to care for that which belongs to God. Even in the Old Testament, but especially in the New Testament, the people of God are not like anything else on this planet. There is not good marketing advice out there, and if we just tweak it a little, we can make this work. The problem is, everybody on this planet, all 7 billion of us or whatever, not one of us naturally wants the product. We not only are apathetic, but we are actually hostile to the product. There isn't a person who seeks after God. And if there's any seeking to be done, it must be God seeking after people who are running from him. How do you administer justice? How do you discern between right and wrong when you are one of the people who has the problem? God doesn't send angels to care for the church. God doesn't send angels to do the footwork, the groundwork, the daily slogging. I believe we're probably surrounded by angels. There are ministering spirits that look after the people of God. But basically, that's behind the scenes. And God takes sinners and says, I want you to care for sinners. And when you're through with them, I want them to be saints. Who's sufficient? Who can do this? And so the first trial is, does God enable a person to do what he's promised to do? Does God really answer prayer? And the difficulty is, if you've been a believer for any length of time, you already have a big list of what you perceive, what I perceive as unanswered prayer. We all have areas in our life that we're not quite sure how reliable, how dependable God is. And that, to be brutally honest, is what makes us look for plan B, God plus. Because we're not sure that he totally keeps his word. And that God helps those who help themselves. And so God is on trial tonight. And in a real sense, he's on trial every day and every night, and he doesn't mind that. He loves to be on trial. If we do things according to the book. Now, as we look at this passage tonight, we will start with the dilemma, and we will move to the discernment. The dilemma. Solomon has asked for wisdom. He is obviously asking for something that isn't obtainable naturally. You cannot go to Duke University and get wisdom. And there's nothing against Duke that I know of. They could have done better on the basketball, maybe. But Princeton, Yale, Harvard, the University of Toronto, You can get knowledge there. You can get information there. You can get misinformation there as well. But you cannot get wisdom there. Wisdom is supernatural. Wisdom comes from God. And the beginning of wisdom, as Solomon will say many times in the book of Proverbs, is a recognition of my own insufficiency and that I am incapable. I'm a little child seeking to do a work of God. And therefore I come with fear and reverence and awe and worship, and I say, I'm not sufficient for this. There's a child custody case. They're in the news more than we'd like to admit. And again, we must remember that the gospel is for a messy, dirty world. It isn't a gospel for a basically good America that has a few faults. It's a messy place. Not just America, Canada, wherever you might be. I was watching MeTV yesterday. I was relaxing a little bit. We don't have MeTV. I thought, what a name for a TV station. And what was neat about MeTV was that the programs, at least the ones I saw, were the ones I saw when I was a kid. And not only did I love sports, but I loved cowboys and westerns. And the Rifleman, and Wanted Dead and Alive, the Boys on the Ponderosa. And I suppose there were a number of reasons why I liked those programs. One was because you kind of know who the good guys and the bad guys were. And two, depending on the length of the program, they usually wrap this up in a half hour or, with Bonanza, an hour. But you always left the program with a resolution. This was resolved. And the good guys, you know, the ones with the white hat, won. And I guess that's why I liked those things, beside the horses and the odd pretty girl. But as I got older and got into this world, what has astounded me is that very few things are resolved in a half hour, and very few things are really, really resolved in the world and even in the church. The king is the supreme judge in the ancient world. All the petty crimes are with lesser judges. But there are certain cases that are brought to the king himself because he is to administrate his kingdom with righteousness. He is to discern between good and evil. And if he is a wise king, he will do that. If he calls good evil and evil good, he will destroy his kingdom. And by the way, every king, every prime minister, every president basically gets the administration that they want to have by the way they rule. This isn't pretty, this story. We're in Jerusalem, the holy city, the city of David, and there are two ladies coming, two ladies who have a profession that we certainly scratch our heads about. There are two prostitutes right in the city of Jerusalem. Now, at one level, you're impressed because imagine the king giving that type of attention and time to two ladies of the night. This is some king, isn't it? But on the other hand, to know that, and Jerusalem wasn't a big city back then, but to know that somewhere near the palace is a red light district. And there's a whorehouse. And there are two ladies, the plaintiff and the defendant. A strange case, because they are prostitutes, and the reality of the business means that if you got any sense of survival, you have to harden your heart. I can't even imagine doing that profession. But they have a child custody suit, and they are able to bring it to the king. And so they come to the king, and first of all, the plaintiff, she says, "Your Majesty, the defendant and I live in a flop house just on 3rd and King. In Canada, every city has a King Street and a Queen Street. We've plied our trade, and in the course of that trade, both of us got pregnant." And you're already thinking, really? The king is going to waste his time on this? Doesn't he have better things to do, bigger, more important, more significant things to adjudicate than a couple of prostitutes who got pregnant? They got pregnant, and within 3 days, both of the ladies have children, have little boys. I don't exactly know the living arrangements, but it's very clear that these two gals live together and live by themselves together. Obviously, they did not deliver in the confines of a hospital or in a family home where there would be care and sanitation and hygiene and all of these things. The one lady has a little baby boy, and 3 days later, the other lady has a little baby boy. Obviously, it compromises their job situation, I would think. And in the course of time, and we don't know how much time went along, but, well, it wasn't a crib death, was it? In the middle of the night, one of the ladies rolled over and smothered her little son. She got up in the night and she took the dead son, put it with the other lady, and took the living son and put it with her. And the plaintiff, when she arose in the morning, and only mums can really, I didn't really know who my kids were until they were about 12 or 13 or 14. But boy, mums, they know every little toe and every little dimple and every little thing. And they might, you know, 2 minutes after delivery, they figured out the nose is from Uncle Joe, the ears are from Aunt Lily, and all this, just absolutely amazing. And in the morning, the plaintiff gets up to breastfeed her little baby, and of course, the baby's dead. And she looks the baby over very carefully and comes to the conclusion that isn't her son. She looks over at her friend and realizes that she's got the plaintiff's son. And you can imagine the cat fight over that. And amazingly, somehow they wind up before King Solomon to have him adjudicate this child custody case. Well, the plaintiff gives her story, and this is what happened. We've recited that. Then the other one, the defendant, cuts in and says, "No, Your Honor, that's not what happened. What happened was that this is really my baby, the living baby. She rolled over on her baby in the night, and she smothered her baby," and they went back and forth and back and forth. Now, the king's got a dilemma. You have to remember, there's no DNA testing. There's no third-person witnesses. There's no video camera surveillance. You've got two ladies who at best are somewhat questionable in their character to start with. And here they are fighting over this child. That's the dilemma. Wisdom's a very interesting thing, you know, because wisdom is finding a simple yet profound solution to a difficult, difficult problem. Have you noticed how difficult life is? Have you noticed some of the messes that your friends are in, your children are in, maybe even you're in? I tell people, my kids gave me some of these gray hairs, but other people's kids gave me some of these too. And other people's kids' parents gave me some of these gray hairs too. And there are times you think, I just don't know. I can just pray for you. And you know that this side of glory, there's no resolving some issues. Now, what is interesting is, and remember, the real one who's on trial here is God. Is God is faced with a greater dilemma than Solomon's dilemma. There is no evidence. She says, she says, she says, she says. But God's got a greater dilemma. He is absolutely holy and just and righteous and sin-free. And how is he going to be able to save people who are everything he isn't? How is he going to be just and maintain his justice and yet at the very same time justify the sinner? And if you don't think that's a dilemma, you just take a course in world religions. Because ultimately, that's what this is all about. And of course, ultimately, every religion has to either fudge on the side of what God is really like. He's not really as holy as the Bible says he is. Or they have to fudge on the side of people that people really aren't as bad as they are. You and I live in cultures and countries that amazingly come to the conclusion that we're really not as bad as we are. Just astounding. But somebody's got to be bad. Because if I'm not wrong, and it was my parents' fault, but they can't be wrong, so it's got to be their parents' fault. And, you know, where kind of does it stop? And if it's this institution or that institution, education, government, whatever it might be, well, they're still ultimately put together by people and they're run by people. And the trouble is, every night on the news, whether we want to believe it or not, we come back to the fact that there's something wrong with people. You have a fascinating president, at least to us in Canada. Is there method to his madness, or is there just madness? We have a prime minister who announces, even on cloudy days, that it's a sunny day. And he is able to take selfies with anybody who will smile with him. And he has an amazing ability of continually spending money that doesn't belong to him. And I'm not knocking because we've been through it all. You've been through it all. And we pour money after this and down this hole and that hole. And we never come to the conclusion maybe there's something wrong with people. Well, fortunately, God didn't have to fool around like we do. And he knew from the fall of Adam and Eve, there is something terribly wrong with people. And yet, amazingly, in Genesis chapter 3, he makes the commitment that he, as a just and holy God, will justify sinners. Now, we shouldn't be surprised because that wasn't a spur-of-the-moment decision. That was just a pronouncement of an eternal decree that was determined when nothing existed but God. That he would save sinners. And do you know how he'll do it? He will take a virgin, not a prostitute. He will take a virgin and enable her to conceive. And that would be amazing enough. But she will bring into this world the eternal Son of God. That's a head scratcher. That is going to take us all eternity to be able to plumb the depth of the wisdom of God and the fact that he is able to enter into human history with all of the mess, and he is able to save sinners. And he is able to save them by the perfections of his holiness and righteousness. Well, that's the dilemma. What's the discernment? Well, Solomon says, she says this, she says that. She says that, she says this. It's not even a he says, she says, it's a she says, she says. And the trouble is, like I say, there's no DNA testing. You can't really tell. To be honest, all kids look the same for about the first 12 years anyways. And or a little less. And so what Solomon is going to have to do is produce his own evidence. And so he asks for a sword. The sword solution. And you could just imagine, because the courtroom's full, everybody must have gasped. What in the world is he going to do? And he says to his trusty swordsman, what I want you to do is take the living baby, just cut this baby in half, give one to she says, and give the other to she says. That should settle it. That should figure it out. Well, the plaintiff immediately says, Your Majesty, I dropped the case. Give her the whole baby. And the other lady says, yeah, I think that's a good idea. Let's chop this kid in half, and we'll each get a half, and we'll go home. And the king says, I've got all the evidence I need. Give the baby to the plaintiff. That's the real mother. Because she would do anything to save the life of that baby. You see, Solomon was looking for internal evidence. He was looking for heart evidence. And he is looking for a mother's heart in spite of all the crud. You wouldn't think there'd be a mother's heart after a woman's been a prostitute, I would think, for more than 6 months. You wouldn't even think there was a heart at all. Well, the result was absolutely amazing. And in verse 28, all Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king, because they perceived that the wisdom of God was given him to do justice. God passed the test. Now, we need to understand a few things here. This isn't just an interesting story. This isn't just a human interest story. This isn't just a story to make Solomon look good, because so far he hasn't looked that good, has he? He certainly hasn't looked much better than me. If you remember in our introduction this morning, we said that the life of Solomon exists for two reasons. One's a precautionary tale to be told so that we can see, is there any of Solomon in us? But the life of Solomon is preparatory. That it's preparing us in 970 BC for a king who is greater than Solomon. A king who is going to come into the filth and the grime of this world, whether it's in the red light district of Jerusalem or in the justice courts of the nation, or in the back rooms of the business dealings, or in the sports arenas, or in the homes. He is going to come into this world, and he's going to be greater than Solomon. I told you about our dear friend, Nan Green, this morning, the lady who died at 93. Do you know, Jesus has sword solutions for things? To get that sword and even to think about it seemed incredibly cruel and harsh and inhumane. You're going to take an innocent little baby that had no say in none of this, and you're going to kill that kid? And you see, the interesting thing about Jesus is that he's always adjudicating. And he's always sifting for the real evidence. And what he's sifting for is to see the internal evidence, the heart condition of people. Because what he's looking for is, who are his true children? Who are the real children? Who are those children that are supernatural, that have been saved by him and redeemed by him and helped by him and kept by him? And what Jesus is always looking for, we look for the external evidence. We want to see how big the attendance at church has been, how the offerings are doing, how this is and that, and all the other things. And much of it, we have to judge by externals. And you know, when they were looking for a king, David, Samuel kept saying, well, there's a good-looking strapping guy, pretty nice on the eyes, this guy and that guy. And God comes to Samuel and he says, you know, I don't judge like that. I look inside. And you see, for every true child of God, there are times when it seems like the King Jesus takes the sword and is about to put us to death. And the true believer says, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. You see, the true believer has a heart that's been super. You don't come up with a motherly, maternal heart. That's a gift from God. And what's even more a gift from God is a heart that loves God. A heart that says, yes, this hurts. There is no way that that woman, kind of, you know, high-fived the bailiff and walked out of there whistling and said, well, at least the kid's living. That tore her heart out to give that kid away. And we go through trials as the children of God. And at times it tears the heart out of us. It breaks the heart of us. And yet, at the end of it, we say, but I know he's right. I know what he's doing. I don't understand. I don't get it. But all I can do is stand back and be lost in wonder and love and praise and amazement. I don't know about you, but, you know, I say my prayers when times are good. I pray when they're not so good. Have you noticed that about you? And have you noticed that when the judge comes into your life, because judgment begins with the people of God and begins to inflict things on you that you're convinced will be the death of you. Have you noticed, as much as it hurts, you want him to continue? You want him to continue. Because in your saner moments, you're not deceived about you. Other people may be impressed, but you know the truth about you. There's not only a little of King Solomon in me, but there's a little of the prostitute in me as well. It is scary what I would sell my soul for if it wasn't for Jesus holding on. And you see, when God brings the sword solution to people's lives, as I mentioned this morning, the false believer says, I don't have to take this. I don't need this. I thought everything goes better with Jesus. I thought every day with Jesus was sweeter than the day before. I thought we were climbing up Sunshine Mountain. And I don't have to take this. I took that, and I took that, and I took that, but I'm not taking this. I've had enough. And people that we've worshiped with, people that we've ministered with, have left. And they don't like the sword solution. You're messing with me now, God. And I don't like it. Buzz off. Get lost. I don't even think I believe there's a God anymore. But the true believer says, oh Lord, this hurts. This really hurts. But do your work. Because you see, like the trial, it's a matter of life and death. And I need to know, am I truly saved? Is there something supernatural about me? Do I love the God I used to hate? Is my greatest grief over my unbelief? Has that providence shaken me a little bit and said, Don, you've been playing with little sins. Stop it. And I have to agree. I have to admit, Lord, deal with me, deal with me. This is not only a matter of life and death, this is a matter of heaven and hell. Do you know how many Baptists will be in hell? I don't, but there'll be an awful lot of them. And Anglicans and Presbyterians and Pentecostals. And not because of some poor theology. It's when they are touched. The internal evidence says they have no heart for this. Can you imagine that other woman walking away with her half of a dead baby and say, well, I wonder how many tricks I can get tonight. It's going to be a good night. It's Friday night. Oh, I guess not in Israel. That wouldn't be a good night on the Sabbath, but whatever their good nights are. But the other woman says, no. You can do anything you want to me, but don't touch the child. And the believer says, oh, you can do anything you want to me, but don't touch Jesus. Because in the great dilemma of life, when I was lost and there was no way for a sinner like me to ever be saved, Jesus saved me. He laid down his life so that I could live. He's just touching my life. He's just coming to me like a great surgeon, a great physician, and he is getting in with the knife and taking out the cancer, the thing that'll be the death of me if it is not removed. You see, there are really three people on trial, aren't there? There's God, there's the two ladies, we'll count them as one, and there's you and I. And when we come and go through our lives, and some of us have been in the narrow way many, many years, and we think, we passed the test. We passed the test. We don't need any more. And the Lord says, oh, I want to touch you again. I want to touch you again because you're precious to me. You're my chosen child. And no one is sufficient to rule over you or save you but Jesus. I never messed with girls. I've never drank a drop of alcohol. I've never smoked a cigarette butt. I've never been near drugs, except being near people who were on drugs. Do you know what my damning sin was? I was convinced that if Jesus Christ took over my life, he would ruin it. I was convinced I loved me better than Jesus loved me. I was convinced I knew better than Jesus knew what was best for me. Do you know that's treason in this kingdom? High treason should be taken out and shot at high noon and even forget the blindfold. A smart alecky 16, 17-year-old kid thought he knew better than Jesus. And you see, I've been saved 52 years, and I've never smoked, never drank, never messed with girls. But do you know what I still struggle with? I think I know at times better than Jesus what's best for me and for other people. Have you ever thought, boy, if I was Jesus, I wouldn't do that to her? Oh, we have no clue. And you see, the problem is, we need wisdom. And wisdom is seeing life the way God sees it. I was born with a disability. Initially, they said I would never walk. Then they said I would never walk. I would never live, I'm sorry. Then I would never walk. They came to my parents when I was about 3 years old, and they said, if we do not do this surgery, Don will never walk. But if we do this surgery, he's a scrawny little guy, I don't think he'll get through it. And my mom told me many years later, my dad made the decision, he'll have the surgery. And I lived, and I walked, and I got saved. And you see, the one who's my judge is my personal physician. And he says, Don, you'll need further surgery. They didn't do one surgery on me. Don't look, but there's scars everywhere. And don't look, but there's scars everywhere where God has had to remove all kinds of cancerous things that would have damned me. And there's still marks. There's still indicators that if we leave Don alone, he may not make it. I don't want them to leave me alone. I'm almost at the end of the race. I'm like Pilgrim. I'm hearing things and seeing things that I never saw earlier. And I'm at a stage and an age where dear friends have gone on before. I've had the privilege of doing their funerals, and I've seen how they died. And I see how their wife or their husband has responded. and know it will be worth it all. There's a day coming when I will live like I've never lived before. I'll walk like I've never walked before. I will be sin free. I don't know if they'll have t-shirts in heaven that says this body is sin free, but mine will be. Everyone will be. And red and yellow, black and white, you will notice that we will all bear the image of the judge. It will be obvious. Just like she knew who her child was, it will be obvious we're all in the same family. Because we will never, ever, ever, ever get over loving Jesus and worshiping our Father and loving our brothers and sisters. I have a feeling when I get to heaven, I will have lots of questions, but when I see him, I'll say, forget it. I know. I know. Court cases. Don't be deceived by the ones that are going on in the news. The real issues are you and God. We know how he's doing. We have, you see, in court and law, they have all these books on their shelves with precedents. Previous trials. And this Bible is filled with how God has dealt with people. So there's no doubt about him. And all he wants me to have is a learning heart that will hear and heed what the word says. Amen.